This is Walter and Zofia Nurse, recorded by Chris Alden Lee on the 6th of July, 2012. Walter and Zofia Nurse.
My name is Walter Nurse. I was born in Liverpool on the 7th of May, 1948.
So how old are you now, Walter?
I'm 64 now.
Okay. And your lovely wife?
My name is Zofia Nurse. I was born on the 21st of April 1950 in Szczecin, Poland.
And what is your nickname? What's your name?
My nickname, friendly name for friend, Zosia.
Zosia, okay. I'll talk to Walter first and come back to you. When you left school, what sort of career were you looking for, Walter?
Well, from quite an early age, I always wanted to be an electrician. That was my goal. I got an apprenticeship with the local electricity board. They were electricity boards then, they were owned by the government. Served my time with them. The company's policy at that time was when you came out of your time, when you finished your apprenticeship, to leave, go and get some work experience in other jobs, other places, and then if at some future date you'd been a good lad or a good girl, they would take you back. Mm. So I finished my time, 1969, I went to work for the alarm company Chubbs, putting burglar alarms in. Ended up as a bank engineer for them because of my electrical background. Then I set up my own business. I worked for myself for nearly 4 years. That went on to work for a company called Lamb & Watt. They were a major wine and spirit makers. They weren't sort of bottlers, they actually made the stuff. And it was from there that I joined Bass.
Well, what was your first knowledge that a place like the Antarctic might exist?
Well, I suppose really from newspaper clippings, articles, maybe little bits at that time. There wasn't very much in on the television and cinemas then. And it was always one of them places that you think, wow, would I give my eye teeth to go and work there? But how does a lad from Liverpool apply for a job in the Antarctic?
Yeah.
But it was always one of those places you think, one day, maybe. And
had you been inspired by something?
Well, I always liked travel. Always liked travel. I mean, before I went south, I travelled all over Europe under my own steam. And it was always sort of, I always fancied going to Greenland. but there was, at that time, there was no travel arrangement, nowhere to go to Greenland. And to go to the Antarctic, there were no travel ships, no holiday people going south. So it was a case of, when this advertisement appeared in the Daily Telegraph, you think, oh, maybe.
Right. So had you read about Shackleton and Scott?
Oh, yes, yeah.
Have you seen a film?
Well, I'd seen both Shackleton's original film, South, and the snippets that were of Scott. I mean, being heretic, Shackleton was always the more heroic of the two. Scott, I think, was a very heroic man. Very heroic man. And what they did scientifically was fantastic. Maybe with hindsight or looking at other people, maybe he'd have got back to his winter quarters. But of the two, Shackleton was always the better for me.
So what year did you apply?
1976, the early part of 76. I've seen the advertisement, and actually, even as a story behind the advertisement, I've seen the advertisement in the paper. At that time, I was working for Lamb & Watts, and I said to my engineer, a guy called Alan Graham, I'd love to do something like that. And Alan said, why don't you apply for it?
Oh, right.
And I said, Alan, I've got a City and Guilds T4. I said, I haven't got a degree. I said, I'm sure they won't take anybody like me. And he badgered me and badgered me and badgered me until in the end I said, I'll apply. I applied and got the job, much to my amazement.
What do you remember about the interview?
Well, rather than amusing thing, sadly Jim Conroy's not with us anymore, but being a Liverpoolian, Jim said there was him, there was Eric Salmon and Ricky Chin on the interview panel. And Jim said, why do you want to go to the Antarctic? And I said to him, why to this day, I don't know. I said, I've always had a thing about nuns' gym, and penguins are the next best thing. So it must have tickled somebody's chords because they gave me the job.
I've heard that one before. Do you remember? Was it a tough interview, or was it just
no? It was very. For me, it was very informal. Or I felt it was very informal. When we'd finished with, or when I'd finished with Ricky, and brain's gone dead, the other two, they said, "Go and have a cup of coffee." And you know, so we went into the restaurant in the old Bass headquarters then. And this chap came up and said, "Oh, hello, who are you?" And I told someone who I was. "Oh," he said, "you're on your own." So I was actually with my dad. Dad had brought me down, and he was chatting away. I then found out later that this person who'd been chatting to me in the restaurant was in fact the permanent base commander for South Georgia. So whether that was a part of the interview or not, I don't know. But
did he want to go to South Georgia? It's not quite the Antarctic.
No. To be honest, I didn't know much at all about South Georgia at all, other than the fact that Shackleton was buried there. And it wasn't until we came down to Cambridge and we had a full week here, going through what you were going to wear, where you were going, who was going, meeting all the other people and so on, that you got to know who was going to what bases. South Georgia at that time, I don't know whether it still has, but it had the reputation of being the Banana Belt Republic, which is probably in some periods of time rightly deserved, but other periods of time it pretty close to Antarctic down there. But beautiful island, absolutely beautiful island, and I would go again tomorrow.
All right. Shall we talk to the missus?
Yeah, by all means.
Tell me about what you did when you left school.
After school, at the time in Poland, to go to university you need to pass entry exams, and I applied to go to Academy of Agriculture and Institute of Fisheries, and at the time that was the only faculty in Poland that was of that direction of studies, and the same, because that was the only faculty in Poland, they only took 60 students and only 12 women or 12 girls. So you can imagine the competition to get a place on the courses. I was unsuccessful for the first time, and because at the time was very state control control to obtain a place at university, and everything was engineering by the state, that you need obtain certain points for everything. So because I was short of 2 points to gain the entry, I worked for 6 months in fish factory to as a worker, to so next year when I went again for the exam, I obtained the extra points to help me pass the exam. And second time I was lucky, I passed all my exam plus the points by working, and I gained a place, which that was in 1969.
Why did he want to go into that kind of work, that kind of study?
I didn't, that was sort of second choice. Originally, really, I wanted to be study law. But to study law, I would need to go to another city. And at the time, because my parents own a bakery, a very small privately owned bakery. I wouldn't get any help from the state as grants, place to live, nothing. So not to burden my parents, I pick a place in Szczecin, so I can live at my parents' home and just travel locally to this place. But soon as I started the course, I was really, really very interesting and progress to finish. And at the time in Poland, my study took 5 years. For the first 2 years, everybody was doing the same courses. And then after second year, we split. And I choose marine food technology. And rest of my friends, mostly boys, took oceanography. And after 5 years, I need to do thesis for my MSc and in Institute of Marine Food Technology, and the professor Edward Kołakowski. And when I finish, which took whole year, he asked me to stay as an assistant researcher, and which I started work in Institute in 1974, and was part of all sort of work, scientific work, in our institute. I must say that Professor Edward Kołakowski was very advanced thinker for those times. Amongst all our work, we were involved in production of fish sausages and fish hamburgers.
Is that fish, comma, sausages?
No, actually made out of...
Fish, sausage made of fish.
Yeah. And which was not so good, really. But I must say the hamburgers were really, really good. And actually they went into mass production that later... a fish factory in Świnoujście, where we did all our research, introduced full production of these products and went into the market.
That doesn't sound like the prelude to a trip to the Antarctic. How did you...
No, then because my professor was very sort of, I would say... He went to all sort of like on a scientific trip. He went to Japan, Denmark. He came to England. Actually, he went to Scotland to do his own research. And he was, of course, very involved with other institution in Poland. And there was a sea academy in Gdynia. There was rivalry between these two institutions, I must say.
Rivalry.
And he got to know that there was going to be second Antarctic expedition on research ship Professor Siedlecki. And later I find out that he did a battle for me to join the expedition, because what I was researching, my part of research in institute was to looking in solubility of proteins in water and in sodium chloride. and that sort of was a way for to look into krill and Antarctic fish, using that method to find out how much you can extract soluble protein from krill and Antarctic fish.
So the idea was to try and draw from krill human food, food for human
food. Yeah.
Did that because, ever happen?
No. Because of the enzymes.
I see.
Because the enzymes, there was such a short time from the moment the krill hit the deck of the ship to get the process to
was a problem they decomposed too quickly.
Decompose too quickly, too quickly.
Okay.
So I think they look more into industrial use in paint, in military use.
And this is work you were doing?
Yeah, no. I didn't know. Yeah. Only in food.
How much did you know about the Antarctic? Had you read about the British heroes?
Well, again, I loved to before I came to England. I loved. I read a lot of books, and all right across. From historic books and novels and one of the books that I was very interesting was about polar explorers, but I wasn't so much interesting in Scott and Shackleton, but Amundsen. I don't know, maybe because again in Poland at the time we had. Everything was state control, so any publication, any information on radio or TV was very restricted, and anything that we could find in reading magazines or books, again, everything was very controlled. Mm. So maybe because of that, the books available for reading were maybe very, they directed the way you could read them.
So would people in Poland in the 70s not really know about Captain Scott?
I couldn't tell definitely.
Okay.
Right.
What made you want to go to the Antarctic?
Was really my professor that said that this is opportunity, and they were going another three girls, because I think at the time, as far as I can tell, we were the first girls who were allowed to go to sea, because one of the things that I was interesting before I applied to Academy of Agriculture to join the Navy as well. But of course girls were not allowed. So my professor, because he found out that the girls were allowed to go, and he found one place for me.
What happened in Poland to allow for that change to take place, to allow women
I think probably the major main reason that they allowed the girls to go, because was research ship Professor Siedlecki. Mm. And they wouldn't allow on any ordinary fishing trawler or anything like
that. So it was your specialist
knowledge
that qualified you to go.
Because
as you know, it was another 20 years before British women went south.
Yeah.
What kind of work did you find yourself doing when you got to South Georgia, Walter?
Well, The official title was base electrical officer. A rather fancy way of saying an electrician.
Yeah.
Really, if you can imagine everything from generating it to using it, from the generator and the diesel going in one end and it coming out the 13-amp plug on the other end, everything in between. When you first arrive, you look at this base and you think, what have I let myself in for?
This is on South Georgia itself?
Yes.
King Albert Point, which is we're talking about South Georgia itself.
South Georgia itself,
yeah.
And after about 2-3 months, it's normal. It's a huge responsibility, but it's a responsibility you don't feel as a responsibility until you look back at it.
Mm.
And you realise just what was involved in what you were doing or what you were expected to do. But I also, for my sins, was nominated to be the base fire officer. Well, somebody has to be the base fire officer, so I was the base fire officer. And before I went south, I'd taken the radio amateurs examination. I was very interested in amateur radio. And within about 9 months of us arriving on the base, one of our radio operators was brought out. He had some personal problems, which left us with one radio op. Well, of course, you can't run a base with one radio operator. So Martin Baker, who became the winter base commander the second year we were there, and myself stood in for the radio op. So at least he got some time off. Grossly unfair to expect this guy to, Mal Dry's name, to expect Mal to be at the radio 24 hours a day, so 7 days a week.
Were you learning more from scratch then?
From scratch, yeah. Mal was putting things into the teleprinter and sort of saying, read that and read this and read that. We fudged our way through, did Martin? I'll not say that we were very good at it, but we fudged our way through.
A fib bodge, was it?
That sums it up exactly. It was a fib bodge.
And what was the electrical installment at South George then quite almost dangerous? Was it, or just primitive?
Neither really, just large. I mean, most households in the UK will use about 3,000 kilowatts of electricity in a year. Give or take a little bit. We'll be using 3,000 kilowatts a day. Mm. So you were running 365 times the average household use. We had to take meter readings every day. But underground cables were a cause for concern. We had a problem. Well, I say we had a problem. There was an awareness that one of the main cables feeding Shackleton House was rising to the surface. At one point, it actually showed on the surface, and the outer skin of the cable was abraded. And we were very aware of this cable that was being open to the elements. But we did the tests on everything. Electrically, it was okay. But we were very aware that at any time it could have gone pop.
Mm.
It didn't. Not why I was there. And now Shackleton House is gone, of course. But it wasn't dangerous. It was no more dangerous than anywhere else you'd be working on. The biggest danger really is yourself, because you're on your own. If you're working in a company, there's 2, 3, 4, 5 of you, and you say, I've never come across such a... Has anybody got any knowledge of this or knowledge of that? When you're on your own, you're on your own. You're digging every bit of information you can out of your brain. You've got all your old books. You've got... That's the hard bit.
Were you short of spares?
No, surprisingly, we were quite very well serviced for spares. We didn't have anything like main cables. We had nothing like that. But ordinary cable for domestic use, doing wiring around the houses, sockets, switch gear, switches, light fittings, bulbs. You know, that sort of thing. We were quite well off with, and we had quite a lot of spares for the generators. Our Dent Jennies were Scaniadale generators, and we had quite a lot of spares there for, touch wood, never used while I was there, but we did have quite a lot of spares on base.
Did you see your role merely as keeping it going, or were you trying to improve it all?
Oh no, I think, when I went down, Mick Pauly, who was the permanent base commander at the time, said that it was the done thing for everybody who went south I went down to his base anyway, to carry out one programme or one project for the base. I carried out quite a lot of work on installing the fire alarm in the house, in Shackleton House. It was never fully completed because it was a big job, but that was something that you try to advance the quality of the life on base. Sometimes it's quality that nobody sees, because a lot of things are hidden. You put a socket on the wall, you plug your kettle in, the kettle boils, but nobody sees a bit of cable that goes to the socket. But I think everybody that was south had that goal, that you would try to do something for the base, for the other lads, because you were on your own. You know, if you didn't look after yourself, nobody else looked after you.
So you're trying to leave it a better base, really?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I think without any doubt that was the attitude of everybody.
Did this check? There was a change of name, wasn't there, at some point?
Yeah.
Some confusion over his name.
No confusion. King Edward Point is King Edward Point, and King Edward Point will always be King Edward Point. The silly Antarctic names people wanted to change his name from King Edward Point to Griffican. Griffican is a whaling station. King Edward Point is King Edward Point, and our base was on King Edward Point. Sorry, Antarctic Place Names Committee, but to me it will always be KEP, King Edward Point.
Was it vaguely comfortable, the base?
Oh, the base it was a five-star hotel compared to most bases. Now, the house, Shackleton House, was originally built by the Stanley government for the whalers. Apparently, from what we understand anyway, the whalers were complaining bitterly that they were paying so much taxes through the Falkland Islands and they were getting nothing back from Stanley. And the Falkland Island government built Shackleton House as a hospital for the whalers. And from what I understand, it was never used, or it was never used in real seriousness. And when Bass took the base over, obviously Shackleton House was the house to use, because it had wet lab, well, facilities for wet labs, a huge dining room, rooms upstairs, all modern facilities, central heating. The only downfall with it was, of course, the building was made of plywood, and that eventually really led to its downfall, just rotted.
Were there any scary moments or near misses?
Oh, we had. Well, over at Griffith, we did have a fire at one point, and surprisingly, of all things, the electrical workshop in Griffith was what caught it. We had a little hydro station there that was installed by the whalers that we used to use for lighting the Keno, which we turned into a sports hall. And we lost all that when the fire happened. So that was really quite a scary moment at time, because had we not been able to put the fire out, which we did quite successfully, there is a possibility that the whole of Griffith could have gone, not the base. Basically, I stress again, was a King Edward Point, not Griffith. There is a possibility that the whole of Griffith could have gone up in.
So how was the fire dealt with?
We had, on our base at KEP, we had small Coventry Climax water pumps, high-pressure fire pumps. And as soon as we knew there was a fire over at Griffith, within probably 20 minutes we were alerted. We took the two pumps over in the base launch Albatross, set them up on the jetty, and we put the hoses round the side, and we hit the fire from the back. At one point I was actually holding a hose inside with somebody playing a hose on me, so I didn't burn, but we managed to put it out. And in the meantime, of course, everybody else came round the coal from the base. Probably takes about 10 minutes, quarter of an hour, at a fair trot, and then we had everybody on the base damping down and putting out. We could have lost, for posterity, we could have lost the whole base, really, because there were thousands and gallons of whale oil still in the tanks, and all that. The houses were tinder dry, and they're all made of wood, so it wouldn't have taken very much spark to hit the Keno, hit the church, hit the manager's house. And there'd be no South Jersey government now, and no museum. And
so were you aware that your main task was to keep the flames away from the oil?
Really, yeah. It was when we found the seat of the fire was actually upstairs in the where the, all the old light bulbs were kept. Once we'd found out where the fire was, that was really, we damped down from there. And within 20 minutes, half an hour, the fire was in essence was out. But we were very aware of the oil in the tanks, very aware of the oil. And particularly a chap who, I think Bob still with Spry, a guy called Bob Headland, very well known to everybody in Bass. Bob was very interested in the whaling station and was ultra keen on where things were. And so it was with Bob's assistance and Bob's guidance, really, we knew that there was a lot of oil in the tanks. And so we were fairly aware that there was quite a major risk, but the major risk, as it turned out, wasn't a major risk, okay, when we put it out.
In January 1977, you were instructed to lay some more pipes, some more hoses.
Oh, yes. Well, we had a quite early morning. We had a call, or the radio shack had a call from the Shedletsky, the Professor Shedletsky, saying that we were expecting them in that morning anyway, but they, could they come in earlier? Because for some reason they'd lost all of their fresh water. And it's illegal for a ship to stay at sea without fresh water. So Mick, we were up at breakfast, there was Jeff Leathers, myself, Derek Hamilton and Mick. And he said, could we go over to Gritviken, Gritters as we called it, and lay on the water from Gull Lake, which is the old whaling station dam. And for the Shedletsky when she came in. So we went over, as we were going over, the Shedletsky was coming around the corner.
Did you know there were women on board?
No. And when the ship docked, the gangplank came down and two ladies, much to our sort of amazement, came down the gangplank carrying stainless steel buckets. Bear in mind that our water supply was a 6-inch hose coming from a multi-million gallon reservoir sitting 250 feet above us. So you can imagine the pressure. So can I fill your bucket with my 4-inch hose with its... when we managed to get water into these buckets, and that was my downfall, I'm afraid. It sort of that was where this young lady, who's now my wife for 33 years, came onto the scene.
Sophia, so what happened on board? Why was there a problem on the ship?
Well, to be honest, to this day, I don't know what happened. How this happened? The day before, we were told that we're going to Gritviken, and we had in form of a gazette on the ship, because we couldn't print it any gazettes or anything like that. So we had a big board on the ship, and on that board was everything about South Georgia and how beautiful it is and what to go and see and animals and everything. So the expectation to see the island was very, very high. So we knew that our ship was due after breakfast, which was about between 8 and 9. So with my friend Anya, that I share the cabin, we get up much early. So we quickly wanted to get washed, have quick breakfast, and be on deck and take photographs, you know, as the ship approach the island. So we get up, open, because our cabin had a small wash basin that we can get wash and all that. And we open the tap, and this like a brown water came through. So we thought, that's strange, you know. So we closed the tap, opened again, and this was like much thicker. So we closed again and rang the bridge to see what happened. So they said, dark water, what you mean? So we explained, oh, don't open the tap, don't open the tap. So, of course, we couldn't get washed. So we went on the deck, and the ship was already approaching South Georgia. So in the cabin, when we, before we came to South Georgia, we stopped, the ship went to Montevideo to buy fruit and fresh products and receive mail. And we were told that fresh fruit is can be a shortage on the ship. So me and Anya, we bought a sack full of Granny Smiths, and we kept the apples in buckets that Anya was later was going to use for her taking samples. So we quickly, soon as the ship docked, we quickly emptied the buckets and went down the gangway, because we expecting that there may be will be a tap to get some water.
So you could wash.
Yeah, to take the water back to our cabin and get washed. And there it was. It was unknown to me, Walter, and I think Scobie was.
Scobie was
yeah,
there.
Yeah, yeah. And they just look at us, you know, in a, you know.
What does she look like? What does she look like? Was she long blonde hair?
Bobbed hair. It's quite funny, really, because it may sound really quite sort of there, but the only time in my life I've ever kept a diary was when I was south, because I thought, well, maybe the only time I ever go or do anything like that. In my diary that morning, I wrote, I've met this really nice Polish girl off this ship today, and one day I'm going to marry her. So that bucket did something.
Bucket of love.
Yeah, yeah.
But you didn't speak English.
Very little.
And you didn't speak Polish?
Nope.
No, very little.
So
very...
how did you...
Well, the downfall really was the ship's cook, Henrik, gave me an English-Polish dictionary. And that was the downfall of both of us.
But that was later, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah. that was on the second visit.
You filled your bucket, but, I mean, had you both realised at that point?
No, what happened, because we went back on the ship, and we were told, asked by our captain, not to go to the station, because this was a working station, and unless anybody was invited by the member of the station. So we just didn't go. What we did, once we could leave the ship, because our main reason to go to South Georgia really was for recreation, because after so many months at sea, you start losing your balance, and you walk like a penguin. So meeting Walter was the really a bonus of the trip. So that day, we just went for a walk with Anya and other friends, and in afternoon there was a football match where our crew plus from and station had a football match, and when the match finished, Walter brought on a like a tray cut down oranges, pieces of oranges, and the oranges were like a gold for Polish people, because at the time in Poland the only time oranges were on sale in shops was at Christmas. That the only once a year. And we would hear announcement on radio or television that ships from Cuba would arrive at Polish port, and they were bringing oranges for Polish children. So you can imagine the queues in shops, and eventually when you reach the counter, you only could have 1 kilo per person. So my mom always managed to get the oranges, and she would hidden them in somewhere in utility room, so we couldn't find them. And when come on Christmas Eve, because Christmas Eve is the most celebrated day of the Christmas period, and every one of us would get an orange. So seeing oranges brought by Walter, you know, quite a lot of them, for us was like, he was like a god, you know, where he gets his oranges from.
So you didn't fall in love with Walter, you fell in love with his oranges.
Yeah? Well, to start with, yes. I thought he was very kind, right, to give us oranges. And then that evening, the station invited members of our crew to the station for a buffet and a dance. And then I sort of, we had a dance and a chat, mm-hmm, and, you know, try to chat. And then Walter and Scobie and other asked us, would we like to go and see a glacier?
How did you ask them?
There were other people who were helping.
I think some of the scientific staff. Stefan, yeah, who was the head of the chief scientist on the Shedlesky, spoke quite good English. And through him, with a bit of pidgin English, and pointing and dialing, and photographs, he said, you know, but would you like to go up and see a glacier, and we'll take you tomorrow.
And is it true that the invite to the Polish ship was on the condition they brought the women with them?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I've made it just interject a little. One of the things that we did as a base is whenever a ship came in, whether it be our own ships or foreign national ships, we had quite a lot of foreign national ships in, we always said, if you want to come over to the base, please come over. On the understanding that the whole of, or a selection of the whole of the crew were invited. Point in question, we had a South African ship in called the Protea, South African naval ship. And Mick Pawley said to the first officer, we would like you to come over to the base. We'll do a buffet for you, you know, so come and see our base, how we work. On the understanding that even some of your lower deck crew, who are all African, you must bring some of them. If they're not invited, none of you are invited.
Right.
So that just as
that
a, oh yes, yes it did.
And was that uncomfortable?
No, certainly not for us.
No.
But that was something that I know Mick felt quite strongly about.
That's interesting, isn't it? Because generally speaking, in the Antarctic, the kind of national differences are forgotten about.
They don't exist.
So is that also true? Was racial prejudice forgotten about, apartheid forgotten about as well?
Yes, yeah, I would say so. When we were, when they came over to our ship, or to our base, yeah, absolutely.
So the black and white were equal?
Yeah, and so they should be.
Yeah, I
and
agree.
So they should be.
It's interesting, I've never heard, I've not come across that before.
Yeah, and so they should be. But that was Mick that insisted that we would like them to come over, but the invitation wasn't just for the officers, it was for
black African workers.
For the whole of the, for somebody from each of the crew decks.
Okay.
So there's a little interjection, but it's quite an important one, really. The other thing that we always did, as Zoe said before about the ship being over at Griffican, the only ships that used the KEP jetty were the Bransfield and the Biscoe. And the Forest, if the Forest ever came in. I think Forest came in once. Forest was the Falkland Island ship. They used our jetty. Everything else used the public jetty at Griffican. So they kept the ships away from invited round. If you said to please come round to the base, absolutely no problem. But the ships were tied up, you know, half a mile away.
But in this case, where was the Polish ship?
At Griffican.
Oh, right.
At Griffican.
So you got this invitation to climb a glacier the next day.
Yeah, we went, and we there's that photograph in the bus club. In this one.
No, in that one.
In this one, yeah. In this one.
Yeah. Carry on, it's okay.
And so, just here.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I am in the middle on this photograph. And was very, very interesting this trip because...
It was up to Hodges Glacier. But all those people who know anything about Celtic, it was Hodges Glacier and the Hodges Hut.
Because for the first time in my life, I actually saw a glacier. Because before, my favourite subject when I was in Lyceum, in secondary school, was geography. And we learn geology. And was always very hard to learn all the levels on glacier, how this build up and all that. So when I saw this glacier, immediately my geography lesson just flash in front of me, and immediately could recognize all the levels and what the names were and so on. So it was very interesting. And afterwards, we just went back and with the sort of promise that next time when Siedlecki come back, we will meet again.
Were you comfortable on this glacier or did you struggle?
No, on the first trip, yes. But on the second, no. No.
You were comfortable on the first one.
On the first one, not on the second. Yeah. Okay.
So you knew when you sailed away, leaving Walter behind, you knew you were going to come back?
Yeah, yeah.
Did you know?
We had a good idea.
Right.
Because normally, if ships were doing a return visit, they would say to Mick, we'll probably see you in 5, 6, 7 weeks' time. And Mick would say, get us on the radio, tell us when you're coming in so we can make some arrangements and whatever.
So you had 5 or 6 weeks to think about this lady?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So were you looking forward to the return of the ship?
A bit of trepidation, I suppose, is the right word.
And how about you? I haven't still worked out when you thought that perhaps Walter was a good man.
I think it's just, I don't know, it's that feeling that, you know, he's a good person. And to be honest, and as well, I sort of, not maybe at the time, but eventually sort of cross my mind is that maybe the nothing will come out of it. Mm-hmm. Because firstly, I was from behind Iron Curtain, you know, from completely different system, as to say. And another thing that... Walter was older than me, and so I thought he could have a girlfriend. And another thing is that his parents wouldn't allow for him to continue friendship with me. So there was, you know, I was very on the loose.
That was going through your mind, wasn't it?
Mind, yeah, yeah.
So when the ship did come back,
yeah,
a few weeks later.
Well, a few weeks later, we came back. So I made absolutely sure that all my work is done, that I had free time. So, so our ship docked in, and. I looked through the porthole, no sign of anybody.
Where's Wally?
Where's Walter? No sign. And of course, a pride kick in. So I said to myself, don't bother. You know, if he's not here, I'm not going to look for him. That's for sure. So... With friends, we went for a walk down the beach, and that night our ship invited the station for a little buffet and sort of dance. So I said to no sign of him, not a message sent. You know that something. I said, forget it. So. and on a chance that he will go to the buffet, I said to my friend Anya, I said, I'm not going. And Anya said, no, come on, you know, come. I said, no, I'm not going. So I sat in my cabin, she was getting ready, change. And the next thing, there was a knock on our cabin. So Anya opened the door and she said, this for you. So I had a look, and this was one of our scientific crew. And he said, come to my cabin. And I said, no, I'm not going. And as well, we were told by our captain, as girls, because I was the only single one, the other three girls, they were all married, not to go to males' cabins, because you just don't know what could happen. So I said, no, I'm not going to your cabin. No, and he said, oh, no, come on, you know, just for a minute. So I went, and he said, go first. So as I opened his cabin door, there was Walter standing with this beautiful reindeer skin and explained that he had a little emergency with the engines and just couldn't make it. And this was
in the morning,
and this was his apology. And I got this beautiful reindeer skin and antlers.
And antlers.
You know, thing.
And were you speaking a bit of Polish by then?
Well, I thought I was speaking Polish. Whether I was actually speaking Polish or speaking gibberish, I don't really know. Right.
So we spent the evening together up in the our main mess. And then the next morning, they suggested some group of our crew wanted to go skiing, so they said no problem, we will take you. So the next morning we set off, and as we were climbing up, I started being very snowy and icy. And I honestly didn't feel safe. I was sleeping, and I thought, no, I can't go any further because I can get injured or slip and, you know, fail or something like that. So Walter said, that's no problem. I will take you back. So we went back, and on the way back, we stopped by the Penguin River, and Walter had a little picnic, very, very good coffee, and never forget a blue ribbon.
A biscuit,
yeah. And we sat on a blanket and had the coffee and the biscuit and took a few photographs. And the next thing he said, would you like to come to the station and see my room? So I said, okay. And our ship was due to leave at 16 hours. Everybody need to be on board, back on board. So Walter said, oh, plenty of time. So we walk to the station, and I was like very anxious because I thought, I don't know if that's the right decision. But on the way there, our cook, Henrik, was coming back. So I stopped him and I said to him, Henrik, you must come with me. Because I'm not so sure, you know, if this is a right decision to go. And he said, you will be all right. I said, no, you must come with me. Anyway, he went with us, and the first time I went upstairs to see the station, and I must say was spotlessly clean, because I had a peek into rooms and bathrooms, and was just absolutely, I don't think so girls would clean any better. So Walter made quick coffee in his room and we had quick chat, and then was time for me to go. So, and from station to the ship was about, I would say, 15-20 minutes walk. So I said, we really must go. And Walter said, oh, no worry, we will take the launch. So we get to the launch and get in, and the engine wouldn't start. And we thought, oh no. And the ship was
siren,
you know, yeah, for go. So eventually the engine started, so we quickly, you know, through the bay, quick goodbye, and we run to the ship. The gangway was already up, so they lowered the gangway, so quickly, you know, no support, nothing, just quickly run. And of course the ship immediately sailed, and later my boss came to me and he said, you know, we were really, really worried that you were going to stay.
We've only got a few minutes left, so we must complete the story.
Yeah.
So let's fast forward a couple of years. When did you get to go to Poland?
When I came home in 79.
2 years later?
I was 2.5 years on station. I came home in 79, and as soon as I came home, I sent a telegram saying, you know, I'm back in the UK. Don't send any more mail south. Send it here. Can I come and see you?
So you've been corresponding in your pigeon?
Yes, sort of. Yeah. Pigeon Polish is the right word.
Yeah.
I got all the permissions and visas and everything else, because at that time...
Going to Poland wasn't easy, was it?
No. At that time, I went by car. So you had to have permission for the vehicle and, of course, insurance for the vehicle. You have to purchase before you went petrol coupons, so that, you know, you went to a station, you've got petrol on coupons.
You'd be driving through East Germany.
Yeah. Well, actually, as happened, I didn't. I went in, at that time, there was a ship, a ferry... Polish ferry ran from Felixstowe directly into Poland.
Oh, right.
So that was the way I went in. But everything, you had to sort of guarantee that you'd spend X amount of pounds a day. You had to get a voucher for that. All that had to be done before they would even entertain you giving you a visa.
Mm.
So if you changed all this money, you got all these vouchers, and then they said no. So I went over in the beginning of April in 79. I was there a month, came home, and you came in the August.
Just as difficult for you to come to England, I
very,
think.
Very. At the time, there was a big restriction. You need apply to British Embassy in Warsaw, and on the application form, you need to give them all your details of travel, how you're going to get to Great Britain, where, what time, what day, what time, where you staying, and if you stay in hotels, you need to have a certain amount of pounds per day. The only they didn't require any money if you had invitation from a British citizen, and and when you send all this application, after a few months, they will send you a promise of a visa. And that means that didn't say that they will give you the visa. And of course, by the time you booked your passage, you purchased tickets, you change money, everything. So if you... later, when you send the passport to them and they say, sorry, you have no visa, you lose all the expense.
And financially, your risk was greater.
Greater. So
did you buy a one-way ticket or a return?
No, return tickets.
Did you because, use a second half?
No. Because... really unknown to me, and that is truth. I didn't know that Walter arranged everything too fast to get married, because
you can't trust these Liverpool lads.
Because at the time Walter had was going back to as a station.
Hopefully, I would have gone back to South Georgia.
That was the plan. Was that Plan B?
Originally that was Plan A, but Plan A very quickly became Plan B, came Plan C, came.
Yeah.
But that was already in the pipeline, and they'd said, they being Bass, that there was a position for me south. Maybe not South G, but there would be a position south. And I would be going back in September, October, but didn't happen.
Because Plan A was to get married.
Plan A, we got married instead.
And at the time, I was going to start my PhD work as well. And when I arrived, and for me, very important was a family. And that's very quickly. When I was on the ship, the same ferry that Walter came. There was I couldn't get a cabin space, so I was on a reclining chair. And before I board the ship, my sister met a friend whose husband was chief officer on that ferry. So she quickly said, "Can your husband organize something for my sister?" So she said, "Wait and see. I see what I can do for you." Anyway. Later, he said, just wait in the main area on the ferry and I will let you know what if I can get you a cabin. And so I waited quite late, and eventually he came to me and he said that a Polish family traveling back to England from holiday agreed to give me a bed in the cabin. And this was very, very nice family from London, from Slough, and I got very friendly with that family, and was saying that going to England on visit and all that, and this lady said to me, she said, everything depends on if the family
accept you. Yeah.
And she said Walter's family. And she said, if we're at the port will be just Walter waiting for you, mean that family won't like you. But if with Walter will be his mum and dad, you will be all right. So, and then when the ship ferry docked, and I was in the queue from non-British people, and I must say I was very nicely dressed, you know, very Western sort of style of dress, and the immigration officers were coming up to me and they say, go into that queue. And I said, I'm sorry, but I can't, because, you know, oh, sorry. Anyway, eventually I was last in this queue going through immigration officers. And eventually when I came out, which they were worried that I didn't arrive, because there was very secluded, you know, everything was so closed up that you couldn't see any arrivals. And there was this massive door, and when I opened the door, there was Walter and with flowers and mum and dad. So I thought, I think I'm all right.
At what point did you go on one knee?
To be very honest, before I left Poland in the May, I'd said, you know, will you marry me? I mean, that's mum and dad.
Her
mum and dad. Zoe's mum and dad. And they sort of said, well, you know, sort of, if that's what you want to do, then, you know. Because obviously, big upheaval for both families.
Yeah, yeah.
And to me, to being quite honest, when I left Poland coming home in the May, I left my wife behind.
Hmm.
I know that may sound...
Yeah,
but really, when I came home, I'd left part of me in Poland.
Hmm.
So it was natural when I came home and putting the house together, putting everything together that we could. So when he came...
Yeah.
And this was to Liverpool?
Yes.
Yeah.
Home of the Beatles.
Oh, yeah. And I knew them intimately.
Well, you do.
And Zoe came on the 18th of August. And we were married by special licence on the 1st of September.
Where?
In Kirby, in St Martin's Church in Kirby. Very fortunately, I knew the vicar. And Nick sort of was very, very helpful. He sort of opened...
Nick Porter?
The vicar. The vicar, Nick Edwards. He opened a lot of doors that we could have opened, but it would have taken longer. Nick said, do this, get them to contact me. And he shortened what would have been probably 6 to 8 weeks down to a fortnight.
Liverpool has a long tradition of, I've worked there as well, of being an international port, and therefore international marriages are not that unusual in Liverpool. Did that help?
To be very honest, I never really thought about it. I suppose it would help, if I think about it logically, yes, it would help within the city because it's quite common for, in inverted commas, to have mixed marriages. There were, a lot of Spaniards married to Liverpool lads,
Chinese,
and there's a huge coloured communities. A lot of, I say Chinese. There's a big community of Senegalese. A big community now, and all integrated within the city.
Mm.
The city actually is quite an integrated city. It's a vibrant city.
Did you like it?
Yes. Again, what was important to me was Walter family, that I felt that I was welcome, and especially Walter mom. Later as a mother-in-law, you some people are mother-in-law, I hate it or anything like that. But she was, or she is, because she's still alive, was really, really good to me. And she immediately took me as a daughter. And Walter dad and the rest of sister and brother, they all were helping. And of course, my English language wasn't good. I could understand and speak, but they never mind if I asked them, please, can you speak slowly or can you repeat or anything like that. It was never a problem.
Could you get a job?
Not at the time, because after we married, we lived first with Walter's sister, and then we bought a house in Skelmersdale, which was not so big town, where the opportunities to work were very, very, very
limited.
And as well, we had our two children, so there were small. We had two small children, and for me to go to work and find childcare was just financially impossible.
Okay. I have one last question, which is maybe the hardest. Yeah. Why did you fall in love?
Who knows?
What was it about?
As I'm sat here, I really don't know. It was a matter of fact. It was, you couldn't say, there was a great blue flash in the sky. No. Was it the way she was dressed? No. Was it the way she... It was just... I knew immediately from on day one that this is it.
Sophia?
I think the same. I think it's because I had the same, because I wrote a diary every day.
Oh, you kept one too?
Yes, every day on the ship, yes. For every
what
day.
What did you write in your diary?
That I met this really, really nice person, and the way I, after the last meeting, I wrote that I think I left my heart on South Georgia. So. I think all the personality and the way he, you know, he conduct himself and look after me and his parents, you know, the whole bit, really.
Have either of you had any contact with the Antarctic since?
Only through through Bass and the Bass Club.
You've not been back.
No, if somebody said I could go to tomorrow, I would go.
Right.
The unfortunate thing. And like, my guess is 99% of the people in the Bass Club and who have been south before, if you give them the opportunity to go, they would go. The drawback is pure cost. That sounds awfully mealy mouthed, but the real drawback is because of the distance involved and the specialist transport involved to get down there, the cost is totally prohibitive. Some people are very lucky. And they get jobs that would take them back, like from Spry or from Bass or from whatever. But for most people, I think that most people who have been south, I think without, well, everyone I've ever met would say to you they would go again.
Does Poland still have a presence in the Antarctic?
Yes. At the time, actually, this was like a hush-hush operation. Poland built a Artovsky station, and actually our ship went there to during the build, and I didn't know at the time that not they were going to do that, but when we arrived in Admiralty Bay, there was a big cargo ship already there. Unloading big cabin, you know, the proper cabins and everything, and they had a big industrial trucks,
the bulldozers
that, you know, to so actually when we were there they built the station, and later in the later years actually my professor went with his wife, and actually they winter in the station doing research. So and I had I still keep contact with my institute, not so much with my professor Edek Kołakowski because he retired now, but my other friends because we started together, and now they all professors and have their own faculty, you know, that they run. So we still keep in touch. Yeah. Still in touch.
It's been a wonderful story. Thank you both very much indeed.
Well, you're very
welcome. Thank you very much. Thank you.